All right, so we're at MJE. We're taking up the story of the Tower of Babel. It's a very fascinating story, and it's very challenging also. I want you to read the story, and I'm sure you'll have some questions. What's the big issue over here? What is the underlying issue that the Torah is really addressing? And I told you at the outset, the Torah is taking up big issues. There's nothing petty. There's nothing trivial. The most profound issues are being addressed, albeit not in the way that we're accustomed to. It's not in that open fashion like you read a history book. It's you got to be able to unravel the story, to analyze it, to unravel it. Important point when you approach a story in the Torah is to the Torah is not a book of history. It may deal with certain things that happened historically. That is not to say that the things that are recorded did not happen. They did. And the story in the Garden of Eden, the fact that at one point in time, male and female did not have clothing and didn't think anything of it. And God effectuated a certain transformation due to sin. All this happened. But the purpose of the Torah is not to convey history to us, because there's tremendous gaps. So many things we would like to know. So therefore, when it's conveying a story that happened, it's doing so because the ideas behind it are very important. It's explaining something that we need to know. What would you say is the objective of this story? What is it coming to teach us, to explain to us, in a general way? Okay, so it's being said that it's coming to teach us that we have a common origin. That's true. But don't we already know that from the very beginning? God created the world, and God created the male, and then a little while later created the female from the male that we took up. So now at that point in time, we already know that. So why do I need... This is connected to what you said, but it's not enough.
You speak different languages.
There's a problem in that if you take a look at the world, at first glance, it does not seem to be in line with the idea that everything that the Torah is saying, that everything comes from one person. The Torah is claiming that the entire world, all the different groups and races and languages and cultures, it gives the impression that there's many different human species. That's what it gives the impression of. Yet the Torah is saying that everyone traces themselves back to one common ancestor. We're all from Adam. There's a reason, there's many, many reasons why God chose to have it happen that way. It's brought down. But then there's the question. If without this story, you'd have a big problem. If the Torah did not have this story, you'd have a very big problem. The problem would be, how can you justify the claim that everything traces back to a single ancestor? If that was the case, then you'd imagine everybody would be speaking the same language. Everybody would be speaking the same language. The entire world, there'd be just one people in one culture, one language, and pretty much they'd all be together. When you look at the world at first glance, am I correct that that's what you had in mind? That's what you were heading for? If you take a look at the reality, if you take a look at the world, you see something which appears to be quite the contrary. How do you justify the fact that there's a gazillion languages and not just differences? Is that what you would expect from one family? We're all one family. Not to mention what else? The claim of the Torah that we're all one family is also contradicted by the phenomenon of endless, constant, continual human strife, warfare. And there's never been a time when there's no war. What's the longest that the world has gone without war? What's the longest peace that's recorded? Very, very rare, but continuous. It's not merely the fact that there are many, many cultures, many, many languages, and many different races, when indeed it would seem that the idea originally was that mankind should be united. Okay? So this story succeeds in providing the answer. There's a reason why this happened. In the nature of things, the way God created the world, man has free will. If mankind had lived in accordance with the divine plan, you wouldn't see what you see today. You would not see the phenomenon of all this diversity and all the strife and all the different cultures and all the languages. That's what the objective of this story is. This story is going to show us how it happened, why it happened. And it's starting off at the biggest thing. They were all united. Everybody spoke one language. And everybody was united. Okay? Let's analyze the story. What are some of the questions that you should raise? I'm trying to give you methodology. You got to start by analysis. Yes, we have a tradition that Adam, Adam had to have a language. He spoke to God. So it's in our tradition that the language was Hebrew. So for the sake of the story, let's assume it's Hebrew. Great, good question is being raised. It seems probably the most major question. What were they doing wrong? The plain implication is that they were involved in some building project. There was a massive, this was clearly the first what? The first instance of what in history? What were they doing? The first skyscraper. The idea of a skyscraper is not the modern thing. It goes back, they were building a skyscraper. Because it says the tower, and with the top going all the way into the heavens. So, I mean, how tall it was, I don't know, but it was a skyscraper. Was it as tall as our skyscrapers? It's just an expression. Probably not. I don't think they had such tremendous engineering ability, although they did have construction capability. They built the bricks. They knew how to make the bricks and so forth, and they had to really put a lot of effort into this, the engineering of the whole project. But it seems, so what's so terrible? Isn't that a good thing? We read about the generation of the flood, that they were at odds with each other, and there was corruption, there was oppression, so mankind was not united, and God brought the flood. Here you have the exact opposite. You have a picture of a people that are working together harmoniously. And God takes a look. Let's take a look at the verses. Let's just go. All the world spoke one language, and they had a singular idea or philosophy. There was not just the fact that everybody speaks the same language. You can speak the same language and completely disagree. You know, everybody speaks pretty much in America English, but there are different philosophies. So just because in addition to speaking the same language, but they sort of had a common understanding, a common attitude. And this takes place roughly about 100 years after the deluge, after the flood. So they traveled from the east, mankind, regenerated mankind, and they found a valley in the land of Shinar, and they dwell there. Okay, they dwell there. Then they said, each one said to, they all discussed, apparently this is a popular idea, come and let us make bricks, and we'll burn them well in fire. And then the brick served them as stone, and the, what's it called? What's that? The mortar. And they made some kind of cement, bricks and cement, in order to construct the building blocks. Those were the building blocks. Now, they said, come and let us build a city. Ah, so they wanted to build a city. That's progress. That's good. With a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed throughout the earth. That's what they said. Is there anything over here that seems such a terrible thing, like it's an evil kind of a plan? That doesn't seem to be that way. The fact that people are getting along and they wanted to create a certain city with a certain permanence and so on and so forth would seem to be a good thing. But you see, you never can anticipate the Torah. You never can anticipate the reaction of God. Man has his own imaginations. We may think that our plans are terrific. God may not like it. Did you ever experience something like that?
Yeah.
You thought, right? You thought what you were doing was so wonderful, so idealistic, but God didn't like it. Okay, that happens. That's how we learn. We modify ourselves. Let's continue, though. And then it says that God came down. Now, you know not to take that literally. God doesn't go up and God doesn't come down. It's just an expression. The Torah uses that to indicate. It's to teach us a lesson, by the way. The rabbis say that the Torah depicts God as coming down to look. In many places, the same thing by Sodom and Gomorrah. God said, let me come down and see whether the evil that I hear, whether it's really that bad as the appearance. Now, of course, what do you mean God comes down and see? Well, God doesn't have to come down and see. It's coming to teach us a lesson. What's the lesson that idea is coming to teach us? It means to say that some... But you see, of course, if I say don't jump to conclusions, everybody will agree. I know that. But sometimes it appears to be so absolutely clear to you, and you can't imagine. Can't imagine. I mean, I get that a lot. I do counseling. Like sometimes one person will come and they'll describe how somebody else was mean. And they bring out, you really feel unbelievable. I can't believe it. And then you calm down. Then you hear the other side of the story. And then it's not exactly as it's not. So a person should train himself, no matter how compelling something is. If at all possible, don't go by your impression. Reality can still be different. And that's what God came to look down. It's teaching for anybody, judges or anybody in any situation. Don't allow yourself to be swayed by that first impression. You have to be able to put it aside, because it's more complicated than that. Anyways, so God comes down to see. To see. To scrutinize. What's going on here? And then God says, behold, one nation, one language for all of them. And that's what caused them to do this. And now, should it not be withheld from them? Should we not withhold from them everything that they're planning to do? Like, we got to stop this. That's the impression. So then God is saying, let us go down and we'll confuse their languages so that one person won't... God is introducing this. What the Torah is telling you is that left to its own natural course, mankind would have been one language. God took measures. We don't know exactly what God did. That's not how God brought it about. The story's not going to tell us that. It's telling you that the phenomenon is a metaphysical, has a metaphysical origin and a cause. God did it. God didn't like the fact that they all spoke one language. God didn't like the unity. God did that and dispersed them. And God dispersed them throughout the entire world, and they stopped building the city. God wanted them to stop building that city. There's a mystery here. What was in that city? What does that city mean? Therefore, it's called Babel. Because there, God confused the languages. Confused, mixed together all the land, confused. So that's why it's called Babel. And from there, God dispersed them throughout the entire earth. So you have two different things happening over here. You have the confusion of the languages, and then you have dispersion. Now, what it results in, this is, at first glance, this story is very, very difficult. Because the situation that existed seemed to be the one that everybody's, the idea of world peace, today, unity, right? Common language, nationalism. This brings into play, as a result of this, all the forces that have created all the problems. Warfare. Competition is not so bad, but struggle. And nationalism and so on and so forth. All the impediments to world peace and indeed all the conditions that create the dangers of the nuclear weapon. That's, of course, still at the top of our concerns because of the strife that exists. Why would God do it? What was the purpose behind this? What was so terrible about the situation that existed? Everybody's longing to go back to that situation. I'll ask you this question then. I'll ask you this question. According then to the Torah, the dream of world peace, as political and diplomatic secularists imagine it, is that attainable? Is world peace attainable, according to this story? All the diplomats in the world are struggling. Is it attainable? The answer is no. It is attainable. We do believe in that there will be a time of world peace, but only in the Messianic era. That's why it can only come about through the Messianic era, because we're maintaining that it's not a political issue. That it's not a political problem, and there are certain metaphysical factors that mankind cannot transcend unless they get at the root of what the problem was in the first place. If mankind should discover what the problem was in the first place, there was a problem, it's kind of buried in the story. Then, if we could address it. But no one has any clue. Nobody in the UN, in the world of diplomacy, has any idea as to why the world is in this situation to begin with. Can anybody give an accounting for this? Nope. In my opinion, there's no history book, there's no philosopher that can explain the fact of multicultured world, multi-language world. It can't be explained. The Torah is explaining it to you. Can't be explained because it's not a naturalistic phenomenon, it's a metaphysical phenomenon. You look, it's being suggested, and it's an excellent suggestion, that it was a serious sin. God would not take this kind of action unless it was a serious, serious sin. Now, what is the worst sin of all in the Torah? The worst sin of all is pretty much idolatry. Everything flows from that. The failure of man to recognize the creator of the universe. That's vital for man's perfection. Now, superficially, at first glance, you don't see the idolatry. It doesn't seem to be talking about that. But read the verse very carefully. It seems to be innocent. Let's bet bricks, we'll build a tower. Where do you see evidence of idolatry in the text? Yes?
It says, let us make a name for ourselves.
Yes.
And be dispersed across the whole earth. And so the idolatry, therefore, is... There's nothing to do with Hashem at all in any way, shape, or form in the building of this big building.
Very good. Very good. Go ahead. It's very, yes?
They're saying
generally speaking, I mean, architecture serves different purposes. I mean, there's functional. Sometimes it's functional. But it's also an expression of human greatness. You'll see that those people who deify man, who deny God, like communist societies and Nazi, all these regimes that are trying to deify man, they always express it with fantastic works of architecture. Architecture is one of the ways in which people express a sense of greatness. They want to make a tribute. It's a tribute to man. It wasn't a tribute to God. In point of fact, it was the rabbis say, by way of conveying an idea, that what do you think they placed on the top of, at the very top of the tower, what did they place? The rabbis said they placed a sword. The sword was pointed towards heaven. Now, whether they mean that literally or whether they're trying to tell us something means that this was covertly. It was an expression of aggression against God and the deification of man. That's where the idea of a name for ourselves. Let's make an end. Not, it wasn't built. See, Judaism in general doesn't have this worship of architecture and artistry and things. Only when it's associated with exalting God. For example, the Beis HaMikdash, the temple. The temple is beautiful, and the way it's designed, it's intended to be beautiful. Because there you're not glorifying man, you're glorifying God. But architecture per se is dangerous because it brings out those feelings. Those feelings of man's power. Whenever man has that feeling of power to the extent that he feels that he controls the universe, that's a form of idolatry. The deification of man is the most pernicious form of idolatry. Can anybody think of... she's not alive anymore. I'm not going to tell the name of an author, someone who was a real atheist and a very, very, you know, very successful author, writer. And she too extolled. Who are you talking?
Ayn Rand.
Ayn Rand. Have you read The Fountainhead?
Yes.
The Fountainhead. Everybody reads that in high school. No, she was a brilliant person. Very, very brilliant person. Great writer. But she was Jewish, by the way. Atheistic to the core. Atheistic. Denied God. And her hero, I think it's Howard Roark. Yeah. Howard Roark in The Fountainhead, architecture. You know, building these great architecture. Because that really is the vehicle for expressing man's sense of greatness. So... that's what brings God down. But the question is, how do you explain the cause and effect? What is the relationship between the fact that God... Okay, so what's idolatry? So God should take down the tower, whatever it is. God did not even take down the tower. Dispersion, languages. The Torah defines for us what the cause is. The cause is that it's one language... for all of them. And that has the fact that they were unified, that which we think to be a wonderful thing, the fact that they were working harmoniously together. By the way, it was the collective, the glory of the collective. They all came together, they worked harmoniously. The individual lost significance. The rabbis also say that when they were involved in building it, if there was one person was on a scaffold and it would mean in order to save him they'd have to stop the building, they would cast them off. Which, again, it's not necessarily a historical fact. It means to say that that's the mentality, like the glorification of the state, like the communist state, the Nazi state. The individual loses all significance. That's one of the symptoms of a society which is based upon the magnification of man. Apparently, it's more than just saying this was idolatry. God is identifying the causality. Now you can understand why, in spite of the fact that unity and all these things are wonderful, but somehow or other it became corrupted. How do you explain the relationship between the two? What's the cause? The cause is that apparently so they corrupted, they became filled with their own greatness. But what does it have to do with one language and one culture? And why is this the only solution? That's what God is saying. The only solution, if they continue this way, there's no purpose in their existence. Man can't live like this, just worshiping himself. That's not what he was created for. Fine. But what's the causation between that? A dystrophy. All the various charities. Do you ever do a study? How it started? How did the charity start?
Probably by people who
it'll trace back to that particular disease. Now, a person that's objective and just wants to do good for mankind, so why is he going to limit himself to this particular cause? Why not the other? Well, what connects him to this particular cause more than any other cause?
Life experience.
identification. That's me. A person went through something. Generally speaking, you'll see that. That people that have experienced something, and then you read about it in the paper, I was there, I know, I got. He feels a certain identification. So the fact that he feels a certain identification brings out the compassion. And it holds off the aggression. That's what I'm saying. That if there's a earthquake in California, it's going to hit you much, much more. 9/11? 9/11 wasn't the first time buildings were bombed. These kinds of things like 9/11 have been happening. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, they were nuclear. In World War II, firebombing of entire cities, hundreds of thousands of people. 3,000 people is a terrible, terrible thing, but there have been much worse attacks in history. But 9/11, everybody was walking around and said, what? How could it be? How could it be that a building, how could it be? What do you mean, how could it be? It's been happening for years and years. It means, how could it happen to us? That's us. That's too close. It's too close. It's right a few blocks away from here. It's much too close. See, that's the powerful feeling of identification. When people identify, everybody runs out on 9/11, firemen, everybody ran out to help, to help. That's me. You see? So those are the two factors.
Wait, so how does identification relate to aggression?
Yeah. Those two things go together. That where you have identification, it removes, there's no outlet for identification. There's no outlet for aggression. See, now you know why the Jew is always the target. The Jew is a perfect, always the scapegoat, because they depicted the Jew as being different. He's not us. He's not human. Whenever you see that propaganda, all the attacks and persecutions of the Jews were always preceded by the demonization of the Jew, the dehumanization. That's what the Arabs do today. You know, they depict the Jew as being an animal, as being a monkey, as being the worst thing you could imagine. Because if you admit that he's a human being, so then how can you just be destroying a human being like that? The Nazis, the same thing. It's contrary to the psyche of man. He can't destroy someone with whom he identifies. We're both human, after all. So therefore, the whole propaganda machine, the whole objective is the demonization. Whenever you see that, it's bad news. Because then there's no guilt whatsoever. Then the aggression comes out. So that's why the Jew was always the perfect scapegoat. He was always the outsider. He was a perfect target. And every society has an outlet. They need an outlet because we can't kill each other. We're all the same. We're together. We have to be together. So we need a target. That was the role of the Jew. Now, that's the same thing over here. Except what was the problem over here? Who am I going to fight with? The whole world was one family. And that aggressive instinct needs an outlet. It must have an outlet. The whole world was united. Everybody was, we spoke the same language. It was like, imagine one big family. So you can't go to war against your own family. The situation was such that there was no outlet for human aggression. And as they got together, you see, as they got together and they started building, the aggressive impulses began to manifest. It found a target. The only target that they had was the creator of the universe, was God. And that was a major factor in leading to the idolatry, the deification of themselves. They became that the deification of man is always a form of aggression. Aggression against who? Against God. We're the masters of the universe. In that situation, it's true that they had good qualities, that there was human harmony, they worked together, they were able to build. But the entire purpose of man is to be able to recognize his creator. And once he falls into a situation of denial, and the forces are such that psychologically it becomes impossible for him to recognize the creator, because the creator is the outlet for his aggression, then God decides to intervene. It's very deep. It's very profound. You good?
Okay, so
I think we can begin to understand that God identified the cause, but it was a misuse. The fact that everybody speaks one language is good. The fact that they all think alike is good. But not if it's a misuse of those benefits. Ideally, that would be a better situation. That is, if there was world peace and man recognized the Creator and served God instead of magnifying his ego, that would be ideal. So God gave man that opportunity. Can you imagine if the entire world is working together for peaceful purposes and man is using his aggression in the conquest of nature and technology and study? That would be great. But this was a misuse. Now, once it was a misuse, mankind had no further basis for existence unless God would create the conditions. God created the conditions in which all of the aggression, which was directed at heaven, would be removed from that source. Man would no longer have that powerful motive to hate, to be aggressive against God. And there'd be other outlets. The other outlets would be different. Now we could compete. There's competition. There's a lot of good in competition, by the way. I hold that aside from the metaphysical dimension, the progress of mankind, for the benefit of mankind, diversity, different cultures, different, all this can be a wonderful thing. The fact that there's competition spurs a lot of creativity. Or what the last couple of hundred years, all the technological developments came about because of healthy competition. And it's not good when there's one monopoly and everybody controls everything. Then it becomes absolute stagnation. I happen to think, as I said, there's two different strands of interpretation. There's another strand of interpretation that interprets it along these lines, that God saw that it was not good for mankind. Mankind wouldn't develop. There'd be nothing but stagnation. They reached a point where they just wanted to make a great name for themselves. That's like any society. Every society goes through different phases. When they're young, they're struggling, they're striving, but once they reach a certain point where they feel great, they've accomplished everything, they cease to be creative. So there would be no spur to ongoing creativity. That's another fact. But I think both interpretations are correct. That is to say that I think that the bottom line, the ultimate, was the metaphysical dimension. That world peace is of no value if it leads man astray, if it takes man away from God. And strife, a situation of strife and competition, that man has to deal with that and he has to work on other ways of not destroying the world, that is better because at least it leaves open the possibility that man will not abandon God. What's going to happen in the era of the Messiah, though? In the era of the Messiah? What's that? That is to say, what people are striving for in a secular sense, and I'm not talking about the messianic ideal, what people are striving for, the complete absence of any kind of strife and complete unity of thought, they have no idea what they're heading towards because they're not aware of these concepts. Maybe it would eliminate war, but again, it would bring out these same problems. It would be an atheistic phenomenon. But in the Yemos HaMashiach, it's a different thing. The peace of the Yemos HaMashiach will not come about through politics. It'll come about through a recognition of God. And mankind will recognize the true purpose and the true benefit is that we should use all of our energies in serving God. And when it comes to that, there's no need to be competitive anymore. There's no need to destroy the other person. To the contrary, the more we work together, the greater our appreciation of the wisdom of God. When mankind discovers the true value, there's always war is always because of the overestimation of materialism, wealth, glory. That's what brings war. Iran wants to conquer. They want to. It could be a religious thing too, by the way. Religions have been responsible for tremendous wars throughout history. But it's always because they're not pursuing the right goal. As long as mankind is pursuing the materialistic goal, whatever it is, they want to control the oil. They want to be the one that everybody bows down to. You'll never have world peace. But when people discover the real idea of the Torah, that all these goods that you're pursuing are purely fantasies, they're all figments of your imagination, and the real good is to study Torah and to perfect your soul and to be a servant of God, that's the real good, then that'll remove all the cause of... Then you'll have a different kind of a unity. That's why it says that the Talmidei Chacham, Torah scholars, increase peace in the world. A true Torah scholar is a person that doesn't want to... he fights. He fights with ideas, with knowledge, all of his energy is directed towards a greater apprehension. But he has no desire to harm anybody else. He's not looking for anything. He doesn't want anything from anybody else. He doesn't want to rule over anybody else. Now, when the world is permeated with that ideal, then you'll have Yemos HaMashiach. Then you'll have the Messianic era. Then the peace will be a good peace. There will be but that peace will be rooted in the recognition of God and God's Torah.
What if the Mashiach comes because the world...
People don't want to acknowledge the dominating force of the aggressive component. People are always denying. By the way, everybody feels guilty. No one will ever admit that they're aggressive. People feel very ashamed. Feel very ashamed of the fact they're aggressive. But I can prove it to you. Everybody has a certain sadistic component. Terrible thing to say. Are you calling me a sadist? Yes, in a manner of speaking. But everybody is sadistical. Did you ever notice that the traffic is going very, very slowly? It's a phenomenon called rubbernecking. What's rubbernecking? That means that the accident, there's an accident on the other side and everybody's slowing down to look. Why does everybody have to see it? Of course then they're all, oh, how terrible, yeah, terrible. But it's gratifying. It happened to them, not to me. On a certain unconscious level, Yes, why is the fact whenever there's a plane crash, they get over and over and everybody has to see it, they can't get enough of it. Now, no one is going to acknowledge it because you feel too guilty to acknowledge it, but at a certain point over there, there is a certain aggressiveness in seeing other people suffer. Now, take a look at the movies today and the culture. Of course, it's done in a way that it's, it's based upon some myth, whatever it is, but aggression and destruction is a very powerful cultural force. So the ability to manage the aggression properly in such a manner that it will not lead man to negate God, that's going to be the key.